I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Wendy Johnson. She's medical director of La Familia Medical Center here in Santa Fe. She is our medical correspondent on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, a new title. I'm so excited.
Well, welcome back. And we're here to talk about the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. And you've been writing about and observing how people are not only getting insured, but, well, this is a question. They're getting insured. Are they also now going to the doctor more when they're sick?
Absolutely. I think especially the folks who now qualify for Medicaid, that population that's under 138% of poverty, which is about $30,000 for a family of four, you know, that population tends to have, because of poverty and because of the kind of difficult circumstances that they generally live in, tends to have a bigger burden of illness also than more wealthy folks. And haven't had access to health care in our health system forever, really. And so that there was a lot of deferred illness, a lot of folks that have been using emergency rooms and deferring preventive care, not filling prescriptions, not able to go to specialists, not able to get any kind of diagnostic testing. And we're seeing a lot of folks now accessing the system for the first time.
Are you seeing that in particular at La Familia Medical Clinic?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I'm not sure of the numbers, but I think we signed up close to 1,000, give or take, of new folks onto Medicaid, just Medicaid, over the last few months. That's a lot of people of all ages, usually under 65, because usually folks over 65 can get Medicare. A lot of them have undiagnosed problems, undiagnosed diabetes, hypertension, haven't been taking medications for it. So it's been a challenge, really, to address all those unmet needs.
Are more doctors and nurses coming into the system to meet all this new demand?
Oh, that would be great. But unfortunately, there's a real lack of folks willing to go into primary care, for sure. As I've kind of written about and talked about before, primary care, both nurse practitioners and doctors, and especially those working with that poor population, are really rare, increasingly rare, because the disparities between how much they have to work and what they get paid compared to, say, a dermatologist or a pathologist are growing every year, frankly. And so when you graduate from medical school and you're thinking about what kind of career you want to have, I don't know, do you want to make three times as much and work maybe, you know, a third less? It's a pretty, you know, for most folks who maybe aren't as politically committed to doing this kind of work, it's a pretty easy calculation. Why work so hard? And then the other thing that is in medical school still today, if you tell folks you want to go into family practice, commonly you will get the answer, oh, you're too smart for that, or it's disparaged in the medical field. And so we got to change those things.
I think, and we can talk about this in a moment when we talk about the financial implications of all of this, but it would be interesting in the future to see how this round of medical healthcare reform develops, because at a certain point, I mean, we're finding with, you know, if it's a carbon tax or whatever, you have to basically make the system work financially by incentivizing what it is that you want to happen. It'd be interesting to see incentives for people to go into primary care.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of talk about that. Right now, most of the focus is on trying to do things to encourage medical students to kind of combat that historical bias against primary care that the medical establishment has. So convince medical students to go into primary care, increasing the number of residency slots for primary care physicians. But really, none of that's going to really help unless, exactly as you said, the financial incentives are really changed. Because you can't just encourage people if all the financial incentives are against that. There is a couple of things that Obamacare did in that realm. Probably the most important is that previous to this, there was a very weak advisory body to Congress that recommended the cost structure controls. But basically, they were kind of overruled, if you will, and they suggested a lot of cost controls, but because this body didn't really have any power, they were overruled by essentially, there's a committee of the AMA, which are the specialists, who set the prices. And those prices for many, many years now have been kind of accepted. 90% of those prices have been accepted by Congress without changing them at all. So imagine that you're a roofing contractor, and rather than having to negotiate your price and having to think about competition with other roofing contractors in the city, you can just say, oh, this is what I demand to get paid, and the government sets that price. And that's essentially both for drug companies and for specialists what's been going on up till now. Obamacare has some provisions to change, especially for the specialists, to change that a little bit. It has a body that's a little bit more independent. But the lobbying force of both the AMA and the Hospital Association is so strong that I am kind of wondering if they might figure out a way around that.
We talked a few years ago to T.R. Reid, who had written a book about how health insurance works in various countries. And in Japan, they also set prices. There was a blue book that basically dictated what every single thing cost, and an MRI cost $100. So the doctor couldn't charge more than that. The doctors went bananas because they couldn't make any money on MRIs. They pressured the MRI machine companies to provide cheaper MRIs, and the cost of health, and they succeeded, and the cost of health care went down.
Right. Yeah. That's true in a lot of different countries. A lot of different countries set prices and set them based on not what the doctors say they want, but negotiate with both drug companies and specialists and medical device companies and for diagnostic imaging, for all of that. The prices are set. There's some negotiation, obviously, but the government just doesn't hand over wholesale whatever the doctors and pharmaceutical companies want. In the United States, we haven't, it's ironic because really that kind of negotiation, I think, is fundamental to what we would call the free market. And especially when there's not the opportunity for competition. I don't understand why there's this big opposition to the government, which is the biggest purchaser of healthcare, to really be able to negotiate these. But the Republicans really fought that. And in fact, Obama, to gain the support of especially the drug companies, provisions in Obamacare limiting how much that Medicare could negotiate with the drug companies on prices.
And so basically you have a system in which now more people are enrolled, and that's great. There's more people who can go to the doctor. The insurance companies are happy, as you've written in your article in the New Mexican. Imagine a product. Imagine that you're making a product and the government requires every single citizen of the United States to buy that product.
Mm-hmm.
They're happy, and they will be happy for years to come. You don't have any cost controls on the pharmaceutical companies. You don't, I think, have any cost controls on the premiums of the insurance.
Some you do, actually. There's a little bit of a provision in Obamacare that previous to Obamacare, they could charge kind of a lot. They could pass on a lot of administrative costs. So they could say that, your premium maybe 75% or 70% or 60% was for actual health care, but the rest was for quote-unquote administrative costs for the insurance company. And there's been a lot written about how Medicare and Medicaid have much lower administrative costs than private insurance, and a lot of critique that they were just using that administrative cost to kind of pad profits. And now there's limits on what they can charge for that.
Still, it's a system that, and, specialists are still making millions and millions of dollars. I mean, they're very wealthy people. And you look at it and you say, what happens in a system where more and more people are using it and there are very, very few cost controls?
Right. We'll see. The biggest problem, I think, at Obamacare is not all the stuff that we've been talking about, although, I certainly would have written a different law. I would have written a single-payer law, but, okay, putting that aside, that wasn't going to pass, especially this time. But the biggest, I think, failure of the Democrats, if you will, is the lack of really fighting for a public option. And what that means is that instead of buying, we could have had a choice. We could have bought private insurance, or we could have bought into the Medicare system. And that would have provided essentially the competition with the private insurances to drive those cost controls.
And so many of us were just desperate to do that, I have to say.
Yeah, because, you know, people in that situation where you're making just over what the subsidies and the Medicare and Medicaid pay for, if you don't qualify for any of those things, which is roughly, you know, folks, single folks who make about $40,000 a year are over that. And when you think about that, it's in a, you know, family of four making $60,000 a year probably wouldn't qualify. And when you think about what that means, especially in a place like Santa Fe, where our cost of living is pretty high, it's kind of hard to get by with rent and everything else. And now you're faced with a health insurance premium with, when you add up all the costs for deductibles, for the premium, for the copays, for everything, you could be paying easily $10,000 or $12,000 a year. When you think about that on a salary of 40 or 50, it's a big chunk.
So the Affordable Care Act seems to be a bit of a misnomer, and it's weird because, okay, a family that can't afford it can be paying $10,000 or $12,000 a year out of pocket just for health care, which is maybe a third of their take-home salary or something like that, which is just untenable. And it used to be before this that you could lose your house and everything you own.
Right. So you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't in terms of the way we've structured it.
It's like an improvement.
Yeah.
But it's still really bad.
Yeah. At least you're getting something for this. You know, you're getting good coverage, and it is good coverage. What the Affordable Care Act mandates that insurance companies provide. But that's true. And, you know, people complain about their high tax rates in the United States sometimes. But, you know, other countries, when you look at all the money that we're paying for things that in other countries are free, you know, other countries that have maybe 25 or 50% higher tax rates than we have. So, you know, rather than paying, maybe other countries you're paying 40% of your salary in taxes, which sounds like a lot. But when you look at your education is free, your healthcare is free in countries, you know, France, Italy, Britain. When you look at those tax rates compared to what you get, and when you look at what we pay here for that package of things and what we get, you know, they're getting a much better bargain in a lot of these countries than what we're getting.
Especially that one year that you get sick.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, again, I think the coverage with Obamacare is pretty good, and that's a bright point, I think, that mandating the insurance companies to actually provide coverage that is somewhat commensurate with the prices that they were charging. Because insurance companies were charging really high prices for insurance previous to this, which caused a lot of people to just forego insurance. And what they were offering, you know, was not covering pre-existing conditions, lifetime caps. So if you had an accident one year and, you know, we're just not going to cover anything else and then get, you know, some kind of illness the next year, tough for you. Yearly caps. It wasn't covering contraceptive services, wasn't covering mental health services, sometimes wasn't covering emergency services. So now insurance plans do cover all that. It's not allowed to disqualify someone for pre-existing condition. Lifetime caps and yearly caps also are disallowed. So we did get some good controls on the insurance companies, I think.
I think the question of pre-existing conditions, so-called, being done away with, it's been very interesting. I know for me personally, I still have this thing of when I go into the doctor, because of that whole pre-existing condition thing, I used to just not tell the doctor half of what was actually going on because I was afraid that they would write it down and that I would be, if I ever changed jobs or whatever, or lost my job, you know, that I would be denied health care coverage because I had said something
right.
In 2004.
Right. It happened to me, too. I mean, a few years ago, a specialist recommended to me a genetic test for a very, very rare illness that I really didn't think I had. But there was no way I was going to get that genetic test and have that on my record that I even got it, even if it turned out negative. Because I think even historically, you know, insurance companies looked askance at that kind of thing. Well, why were they looking for that? And maybe you do have it. And, you know, we don't want to insure you. And they didn't have to tell you why they turned you down.
We're talking to Wendy Johnson, medical director of La Familia Medical Center here in Santa Fe. There is a whole other part of this, which is Medicaid. And Medicaid has been expanded, except in the states where it hasn't been expanded. What's going on?
Well, it's insane, I think. It's been called by other writers, I love this phrase, so I'll say it again. I put it in my article, awesome in its evilness. I think that that's accurate. You know, the federal government is subsidizing to the tune of 100% the cost of expanding Medicaid for the first couple of years, and that goes down to 90% in 2016. So the costs are largely subsidized by the federal government, which is a huge boon to the state's economy, let alone the you know, human rights issue of covering folks for their medical illnesses who are poor, who are working menial jobs, who often are working just the kind of jobs that cause them long-term dysfunction and illness. And when you think about how our economy is kind of built on the backs of these folks, and we can't even provide them medical care for, you know, their service and for illnesses that occur a lot of the time because of their work. It's just really a moral disgrace, and I really do think a violation of basic human rights. And I just really can't believe that there won't be some political price to be paid for this. But so far, it's unclear whether that'll happen. I'm very glad that in a state in New Mexico, we did expand Medicaid. So I think that speaks to, you know, our state is very poor. And the constituents, if you want to win a governor's race, I think it's hard to win a governor's race without that segment of the population. And so I'm hoping that other states will respond similarly and send a message in the next elections to those governors that denied the Medicaid.
Why did they do it?
I mean, just political. You'd have to ask them, frankly, because I just think it is...
It's just like, we're Republicans. We, out of hand, despise anything that Obama does, no matter how good it might be for our people.
Well, keep in mind that the Republicans also tried to repeal Obamacare more than 50 times in different ways. And although they've stopped talking about repeal lately, they're still talking about reform and making it better, but they can't describe what that means. I mean, I think there's just a basic divide in our country about the common good, really, about what that means, and I think the Republicans are on one side of it, for the most part the Democrats are on the other side of it, and you know, it's interesting that the country is getting more and more divided, but I think it's a reflection of that. And interestingly, in those states that it doesn't make any sense to me, because in those states that did turn down that Medicaid money, those are the states that have the most sickness, the most poverty, the most illness, the highest infant mortality rates, the worst child health indicators. New Mexico's down there too, but the Southeast basically is what we're talking about. The worst healthcare systems in general. And this could have just been a big boon for the states economically as well, which these folks that say they care about, but it doesn't look that way.
So under the Affordable Care Act, everybody is required to have insurance. We have, what, 8 million new people are enrolled in insurance, something like that. How close are we to actual full enrollment?
Well, that's a good question. I think we have to sort that out. So there's 8 million new people in private insurance. There's about 5 million in the states that did expand Medicaid. And then there's about 5 million who didn't get the Medicaid expansion previously in those Republican states that we're talking about. So there's at least those 5 million. And I think it'll take some time to sort out how many people are left over, essentially. But one big group of people that are totally left out of the entire equation are undocumented immigrants. And again, these are folks that are providing labor. You know, our food system essentially couldn't work without undocumented immigrants and migrant labor. And it's not even, you know, there's migrant labor that's here legally and still is cut out of Obamacare, is cut out of especially the Medicaid provisions. So,
really?
Mm-hmm, yeah, unless you're a citizen. There are some provisions if you have a green card for 5 years, but for the most part, yes. Undocumented immigrants can't even buy private insurance on the exchanges. And so those folks who are you know, literally making our food system work. You know, if you've eaten a Washington apple in the past year, chances are it was picked by an immigrant, and chances are high it was an undocumented immigrant or migrant labor of some kind. And yes, those folks are providing a really valuable service for our economy, and in exchange, we're basically ignoring them. We can't pass any kind of immigration reform to recognize any kind of amnesty, any kind of recognition of their contribution. And, you know, I've been told by folks in high political office that basically healthcare for undocumented immigrants is like the third rail. I mean, even if immigration reform does get discussed in Congress, that's definitely not going to be part of it because no one wants to go there, which is really crazy because we're paying for healthcare for these folks when they go to the emergency room. And it's way more expensive than it would be if we could provide them a basic package of at least primary care.
So what happens, for example, in New Mexico, in La Familia Medical Clinic, whatever, when an undocumented immigrant comes in with cancer or pancreatitis or gallbladder failure or whatever?
Well, essentially, we have to rely on the kindness of specialists. And, you know, there was a program through Christus St. Vincent's to provide access to anyone who didn't have insurance called Project Access. And that program got eliminated when Obamacare went into effect, basically because the assumption that, well, now everybody has insurance, so we don't have to have programs like this. And that happened all over the country. That's not just here. So all over the country, some of these piecemeal programs that dealt with providing specialist access for people who didn't have insurance, a lot of them got eliminated. So ironically now, the undocumented immigrant population is in worse shape after Obamacare, because the access to specialists, or, you know, it's really, and as for diagnostic testing, forget about it, because nobody's going to negotiate with you the price of an MRI. But possibly, you know, there are specialists in town that are great and that do see this patient population and that, you know, work deals with the individual patients and have payment plans that are reasonable and that kind of thing. So there are folks that do some amount of what we'd call charity care or low-cost care for this population, but it's just now completely ad hoc. And it depends on me as the physician calling somebody that I know, asking them, please, can you see this person? And then if they need chemotherapy, if they need something, you know, more advanced, there is a provision in Medicaid that provides emergency care, and some of this is included in that, like deliveries, for example. But a lot of it isn't included in that provision for 95% of the care that we really are trying to get for our population is not included in that.
So what happens to these folks? They die horrible, painful, screaming deaths alone at home?
Well, some folks, you know, we actually encourage to go back to Mexico to get treatment. Yes, I have seen folks with untreated chronic illness, emphysema, cancers, just not get treatment. And that's, you know, that was, studies have been done that show that the uninsured populations have death rates, undocumented immigrants, other folks that were uninsured previous to the Affordable Care Act. If you're uninsured, your chance of dying young is much higher than if you're insured.
For those people who then get green cards, and there are a lot of people who, because they live in mixed families and so on, become eligible for a green card, you're saying that they still aren't eligible for health insurance or buying insurance under the exchanges?
I'm not sure exactly what the provisions are for the exchanges, but I know for Medicaid and Medicare, there's still a lot of hoops you have to go through, and I believe, although I could have this wrong by a year or two, but I believe you have to have had a green card for 5 years to qualify for any public programs.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
So if you could, I mean, this is where we are. Our country moves slowly on a lot of things. We've been waiting for this for a long time. It's such a weird combination of victory and far from a really good bill. In future reforms, how would you as a physician like it to change?
Well, the number one thing that I would have liked to see in Obamacare, and the number one things that I would like to see happen, is the public option on a national level to allow us to buy into Medicare. And I think then we can really see and compare the private insurance market with government-funded insurance, if you will. It's not government-controlled insurance. A lot of people talked about socialized medicine and all that. It's just the government is subsidizing or paying for the insurance part. They're not paying for the doctors. They're not paying for the hospitals. All of that is still in the private sector. So, but at least we could compare those two things. And people could choose and decide. I mean, that's part of the free market principles in healthcare that everybody's talking about. And people could see if this government-funded insurance works better, which I believe it does, and there's a lot of studies that show it does, than the private insurance market.
So, it's sort of like, I mean, people talk about whether they want to send their kids to public or private school.
Right. Yeah. And there's, you know, I mean, we could get into a big discussion about public financing of X or Y or Z, and we can talk about how public schools are worse than private schools by certain measures, or, you know, we could talk about the VA scandal, for example, and stuff that's gone on with that. But the basic fact in a lot of those issues is that we're looking at a government system that's been starved for, you know, easily 30 years now. The education system, the VA system, and there's been a huge, there's been several attempts to get more funding for the VA system in general to take care of the problems that veterans have when they return. And a lot of that has been voted down in Congress. And so now for Congress to turn around and say, oh, look at the VA system isn't working. This is an example how government doesn't work. Well, of course, if you strangle government, it's not going to work. So you have to provide the adequate support. And, you know, over and over, the studies of Medicare and Medicaid versus private insurance have showed for the same money, you get much better service, much lower administrative costs, much more of the money that you're paying actually goes to healthcare in the government-funded insurance programs than in private insurance.
Wendy Johnson is medical director of La Familia Medical Center here in Santa Fe. She writes a medical column in the Santa Fe New Mexican. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.